Hello, welcome back to the ThickCast. This is episode number 341. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and this is someone that I've been trying to get on the show for a while, and it was one of those things where I just completely screwed up scheduling. And then a year later, I'm like, yeah, man, I got to get Brad back on the show. So I'm very happy to have Brad Schoenfeld on the show. Finally, Brad, how you doing?
Oh, my pleasure, Kev. Great.
So, we have like a ton of stuff to talk about, but I mean, if people haven't checked out your stuff before, obviously lookgreatnaked.com is the place to go. And you're doing just awesome stuff in terms of helping people digest all this great research that is being done. And, you know, sometimes maybe the not so great research and making sure that people are kind of aware of that, you know, not all the research that's being done is either applicable or necessarily done, really good way. So, another thing that you're known for is just for getting people in incredible shape with body composition training and things like that. So I'm sure we'll go into that territory as well. But this is kind of like the latest thing is the Epic Summit that happened as we're recording this about a week ago. But we had some people ask, just for your impressions on how things went. I know there was a big debate. There was a bunch of debates that I know you were also involved in. And then Alan Aragon and Gary Taubes went at it. I guess it was a little more one-sided, but what were your thoughts on the weekend?
I thought it was incredible. Richard Levatt, who organized this, I thought did a great job of getting together some of the top people in the field. So there were people like my buddy Alan Aragon, Brett Contreras, Lane Norton, James Krieger. I could just go on and on, Menno Hanselman. And just having all those people in one place interacting, I thought was just really incredible. And the passion, what really stood out to me was the passion for learning for the attendees, that they were, you know, a lot of times there's, as you know, a lot of bro science in this field and people gravitate towards, well, the big guy in the gym told me to do this, so that's what I'm doing. And there's this, I think, movement push towards getting quality information, evidence-based information. And yeah, I thought the debates were really interesting. I had my own opinions on, if it doesn't matter who won. Certainly I was involved in one of them.
Sure.
But they were interesting. And I thought if nothing else, it allowed the audience to see different perspectives and they were able to draw their own opinions from it. So it was, I thought overall a really great weekend and something hopefully will be done more in the future across different continents.
It seems like a really great way to do a summit or, you know, a seminar and to not just get one person's side, but actually to have a discussion on these topics and not have to then compare and contrast afterwards. I'm just kind of curious for all the presenters, I guess I should say the debaters. Everything stayed pretty cordial, nothing too crazy.
It was cordial. Certainly my interaction with Fred Hahn, I debated Fred Hahn, who's a super slow hit proponent, and my philosophy is quite different in terms of what I believe the research shows and certainly through experience as well, but very cordial in that sense. In the Gary Taubes debate with Alan, Gary did tend to interrupt Alan several times through his presentation, which you can take how you want. But overall, I mean, certainly it was not, there was no acrimony, if you will.
Sure.
And I thought it was, again, balanced. One thing that's really cool about a debate is that you can present your side of something, and if there's no interaction to challenge something, then it basically goes, someone can say, wow, that seems really logical. When another person is there that can poke holes in it and can challenge certain aspects, you start to get a better perspective on the other person's true understanding of the literature and how it applies to practice.
Well, let's start talking about research. You know, I'm always talked about being a huge fan of Alan Aragon's research review. Like, again, if you're listening to this, and for people like me that just, you know, don't necessarily want to go through every one of the research papers, did that enough in college and a lot of late nights doing that. Now it's great to be able to, you know, go to people like Alan and you to have you digest the stuff for us and then basically just spit it back out and tell us what makes sense and, you know, really how well the research was being done. So can you talk a little bit about what you're doing with that?
Yeah, well, it's myself and several of my colleagues, Alan, Brett Contreras, and some others. Basically, we're trying to bring research to the general public and make people understand or avail them to the importance of taking an evidence-based approach. And an evidence-based approach means to understand the body of research, because we can all cherry pick studies that try to support our opinion. That's called confirmation bias. That's not a research-based approach or an evidence-based approach. But an evidence-based approach, contrary to what people think, isn't just saying, okay, well, this is what the research shows, so we're doing this. It's understanding the body of research and understanding its limitations, and then taking into account our own personal experience as well as the needs and abilities of the individual. And this is what's really important to understand, that a research study is going to report the means. But when I carry out a study, there'll be huge inter-individual differences in terms of the responses. Some people will gain nothing or virtually nothing, and other people will gain 50, will grow 30 or 50%. And basically what a research study does, it aggregates that. It provides a mean outcome measure. Mm-hmm. And if you just take, well, so I lost 10 pounds of fat on this diet, or I lost 6 pounds of fat on that diet, or the group did, lost 10 pounds of fat on one diet, 6 pounds on the other, you'd say, well, I definitely want to go with the one that promoted the greater weight loss. But that isn't necessarily always the case, because within that average that they're reporting, some people might have done better on the other diet. So this is where you have to then say, okay, well, this is what the research shows here. And then you look at other studies, pool them. You have to take into account who the study was done on. So a study that's done on 80-year-old nursing home patients, or female nursing home patients, will not necessarily have the same applicability to a study done in 22-year-old college football players. Mm-hmm. So if you're a 22-year-old male, I would tend to go for the results of the study that was done, that's called generalizability, the study that was done in the younger fit males, than I would in the elderly individuals. So these are all things that we need to consider. And again, one of my real hobby horses is to avail people to this, to make people understand the importance of looking to the literature, but also to avail them to the limitations and not just looking at a single study, as we often see promoted in the magazines. They'll pull something out of context. We have a lot of now abstract armchair researchers who really don't understand research, and they just read an abstract or hear about an abstract even, and they try to draw conclusions. And that's not the way to take research and then and try to get a practical applicability from it.
Well, you're obviously, you know, doing a lot of research yourself, and you're going through a lot of this stuff. So we're going to go into a bunch of different topics, but you know, this one always fascinates me, because we've been doing this. I mean, people have been training for a long time. You know, we've had people write programs for a long time, trying to create some structure and just some sort of methodology when it comes to designing all this stuff. And, you know, it comes up with, you know, how many reps should I be doing per set? You know, how often should I be lifting? Things like that. So, beforehand, you sent me some topics we can jump off of. And I think that is a great, you know, place to start, because you talk to 10 different coaches in this industry, you get 10 different things that you're supposed to be doing in terms of programming. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, the resistance training variables, what we know to optimize an effect, an outcome such as muscle hypertrophy, which is muscle growth, requires manipulation of training variables. And that's volume, intensity of load, the effort that you're putting in, the rest intervals, and other factors. I'll start off by saying, and I'm sure most of those in the audience here listening will know this, that you can pretty much get an effect, get some degree of muscular adaptations from virtually anything. So when I debated Fred Hahn, I certainly acknowledged that a HIIT routine done with SuperSoul or however you want to perform your reps will build muscle. There's no question about that. It's not like you don't grow at all. It's, will that optimize an outcome? And based on the literature as well as experience, the answer is no. So off the bat, we have to understand that, what are our goals here? For the average stockbroker, I'm just throwing out stockbroker as a profession, but who's just looking to get some muscle and get some basic level of fitness, some endurance, muscle endurance. Yeah, virtually anything you do, you can train a couple times a week for a half hour a session, and you can achieve pretty much most of those goals. If you are looking to be a bodybuilder, a physique athlete, that's not going to cut it. Hmm. So that's where we have to start understanding that as a jumping off point. And when we look at the variables, I will start with volume, which is always a biggie. So how much should you do? Mm-hmm. And really the literature is very clear that there's what's called a dose response relationship to training, meaning that when you increase the amount of volume, you will increase muscular adaptations up to a certain threshold. Mm-hmm. So, and muscular adaptations is muscle growth and strength. So where is that threshold? Well, we know that multiple sets are superior in general to single sets for most people. I'll also say that if you're an 80-year-old woman, that single set, and there's actually some evidence of this, probably at least at the beginning phases of training is going to be enough. Once you start getting more experienced, it's questionable whether that would. But if you're a young male or young female who wants to look great on the beach and maximize the response, there is this dose-response relationship. So three sets are better than one set. There's evidence that five sets are better than three sets. I'm going to be collaborating actually on a new meta-analysis, which is a pooling of all the data, and with my colleague James Krieger, who is a statistical whiz, by the way, and just I've collaborated on multiple meta-analyses with him. So just shout out to him on this. But what we've looked at in the preliminary analysis is that 12 sets a week per muscle group is superior to less than 10 sets per week. And that's a very clear distinction where we're talking fairly big differences in the effect. Mm-hmm. So this is the jumping off point from a volume perspective. Then it comes down, as I talked about before, it's based on the individual. There is no one volume I can give you that is optimal for everyone. So your nutritional status, your training status, your genetics, all of these, your stress levels, all of these factors will enter into, well, how much should I do in a week if I want to optimize results? And there certainly is evidence that beyond a certain point, not only is there no additional benefits, but you become overtrained. So if you do 100 sets per week, well, I can pretty much guarantee not only won't that keep increasing your results, you're going to end up having fatigue, which and it'll have a negative effect on your immune system. So one of the things that I promote is a progressive manipulation of volume so that it peaks over a certain period of time. And that could be over a three-month period, 2-3 month period, but where you consistently increase volume, so you periodize it, and you might go from doing 6 or 8 sets a week to 10 to 12 sets a week, and then you have what's called an overreaching phase, a functional overreaching phase, where you really push your body to its limits. And when done properly, that's how you supercompensate and optimize results. And what you should also consider is to have what are called deload periods. So throughout this, when you're pushing yourself really hard, it could be every 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and differs between individuals. But you have a week where you basically take it easy and you'll train, you'll reduce your volume of training as well as the intensity of what you're doing. And when, again, properly carried out, this is how you ultimately keep progressing without plateauing.
Interesting. So when you are you kind of making these into like 4 week phases or 3 week phases? How does it look?
Yeah, my general training blocks are 4 week phases. Okay. Where you do a three hard, then you take a 1 week deload. But again, that's a template. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned before, that's where the art of training comes in. So one of my favorite adages is that training is both a science and an art, but you can't separate the art from the underlying science. So we know that training too much, that there is a dose-response relationship, and we know that training too much will promote overtraining. How you will ultimately go about that, that's where you have to consider your own experience and the needs and abilities of the individual. So I use that as my basic template. Some people can go longer with their deload blocks, and that's ultimately something that has to be done on an ongoing basis.
So how much does it matter in terms of like spreading out these sets throughout the week? Because, there's a lot of people are going to say, 3 days a week, just train 3 days a week. Some people are four, some are like five, take 2 days off. How do you like to set it up?
Well, I generally use frequency to mediate volume. So, mm-hmm. So I do, let's say, a 3 day a week routine for 3 weeks, a 4 day a week routine for let's say a month, do a 3 day a week for a month, 4 day a week for a month, and then a 6 day a week for the last month. And then after, so it really would come out to like 3 weeks or so. So that's where your overreaching comes in. Mm-hmm. And this, I've used this with numerous physique athletes. And then you use you do 3 weeks at that functional overreaching, then you take an active recovery, often for a physique athlete, that'll be the week right prior to their competition. They'll just do some posing and sometimes carb load, carb deplete. So anyway, these are all, it's a very malleable type of template that I use. But frequency I use, generally speaking, again, to mediate volume. So when you increase the frequency of training, if all other things are held constant, you'll increase volume. And it's a really good way to push that volume. Because one of the other things that has to be considered is that, you can you train for 2-3 hours? Technically, yes, but generally the quality of the training starts to deteriorate over the length of that session. And most people don't want to, either they lose the focus or the energy levels start to dissipate. Most people don't want to be in the gym for that long anyway. So by keeping your, let's say, a workout to an hour 60 or 90 minutes, and then pushing the frequency, you can then increase volume accordingly.
And this is going to be like a super loaded general question, but I got to guess you have a lot of people that are coming to you that are just no longer getting results from the programs that they have been doing previously. Are there any kind of like general or common mistakes that you're seeing in a lot of these people's programming that, you know, maybe the audience can watch out for in their own?
Yeah, so effort is a huge factor here. And the two things I see is either, usually it's an under effort because most people don't understand how hard to train. And I get in my research studies, my hobby horse is to train, or my research focus, if you will, my research hobby horse is to work with well-trained, resistance-trained men. Because we know that at the beginning phases of training, when you're training someone who is a newbie, they're going to have the first several weeks of neural responses. And there's many differences that we can go into if you want, but certainly you don't respond the same once you start getting closer to your genetic ceiling as you do during your early phase. So my criteria is at least a year of resistance training experience, 3 days a week consistently. And I get really large growth. I mean, we're talking 5-10% increases in muscle mass in an 8-week period, the biceps, triceps, quads. And what I find is that we tell the people we're going to really push them, and we really push them. They are just, they're often plateaued. They're going on, and I get virtually the same response from almost all of them is that, wow, I didn't realize how hard I needed to train. I get a bunch of dropouts because they're just not used to handling that type of effort. But also there's the opposite, where there's some people that they just keep pushing themselves so hard for too long a period that they're burned out and they're overtrained. So the effort is huge. And just working with private clients, again, another thing that I get is either the too little volume or too much volume. I get people, they're doing these crazy 1 day a week splits where they'll do 30 sets in 1 day for chest. And basically they're not spreading out their volume over time, where and that a split routine, even a gross split like that, can work for a period of time if it's done in a periodized routine. But ultimately, you're going to need to train muscles more frequently. I generally feel a 2 day a week frequency per muscle group is beneficial, at least for given periods of time. Training them 1 day a week over the long term, from what I've seen both through research as well as through personal experience, is not optimal.
You know, let's talk specifically about people who are looking for, you know, body comp improvements. How are you liking to integrate their conditioning, their cardio stuff? And, you know, another thing that might be a good jumping off point that you mentioned in the notes is that doing your fasted cardio. Again, it's another like internet forum debate that's been had for years. What do you think?
Yeah, well, fasted cardio was something that I'd looked at for a long time. I remember back, I'm not sure how old you are, but I remember Bill Phillips came out with Body for Life, which was, I think still is, the biggest selling fitness book of all time.
Wow, yeah.
And Bill was really an innovator, and based on some limited research back then, he speculated that, and this was acute data, meaning that it was a study done at a given period of time, and they looked at the fat oxidation, fat burning, during the cardio session. Mm-hmm. Bill speculated that if you train fasted, it would burn more fat than if you did it in a fed state. And that, again, was based on this acute data, which did at the time show that. But there were a bunch of holes in that theory. subsequent research, subsequent what Bill had looked at that point, that came out after publication of his book. And basically it showed that while you might burn more fat technically during that bout, there were issues with it. It was done only in very low intensity cardio. It didn't take into account where the fat was coming from. So there was a much greater oxidation in well-trained individuals, especially from intramuscular fat rather than the fat, what's called subcutaneous fat, which is around the midsection and the underneath the skin. So a lot of holes in that. And recently my lab carried out a study that looked at it in a longitudinal basis where we actually looked at body composition changes associated with fasted cardio. And we basically found that there was no difference in fat loss or body comp, any body comp issue, a body comp measure from fasted versus fed cardio. And as far as what I recommend, well, if your goal is to maximize muscle gain, cardio is not really your friend. It's not going to help your gains. Although here's an interesting thing. I will give a caveat to that. In untrained subjects, it's been shown that cardio actually will help muscle gains during the very beginning of training in some individuals. Hmm. So, but once you start becoming more experienced, the body has limited energy reserves. There are intracellular issues where there are competing intracellular pathways from doing cardiovascular type exercise, aerobic type exercise versus resistance training, and that can have negative effects. Now, does that mean that if you go out for walks with your dog, you're not going to be able to gain muscle? Absolutely not. So this is where, again, it's going to, there's no absolute I can say other than you need to be cognizant of this. You need to, I would say, limit the amount of cardio you're going to do. If you're going to be a marathon runner, you're certainly not going to maximize muscle growth. So keep that in context. I like to try to optimize fat loss through diet primarily, and then use cardio as an adjunct. And also, if you want to maximize muscle gain, you need to be in a caloric surplus, meaning that you need to take in more calories than you expend, particularly as you get closer to your genetic ceiling. So the leaner you are and the more well-trained you are, you're just not going to maximize muscle mass if you're staying very, if you're trying to stay lean. You're going to need to gain a little bit of fat along the way to gain some muscle with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's stick on the topic of nutrition for a little bit, because we also got some questions on Facebook just about meal frequency. Again, another, you know, hotly debated topic about whether you go 2 meals a day, 1 meal a day, 6 meals a day. I mean, that was a big hotness. What was it, like 8 years ago now? That was 6 meals a day. But, you know, what is the research showing you? And, you know, what do you think is, or again, like what is the advice that you would give someone for, you know, maximizing their body comp?
Yeah, this is a really interesting case because, first of all, I was a big proponent of the 5-6 meals a day. I did a competitive bodybuilding for quite a number of years, and I adhered to the old, what I would call bro science at this point. And this is a case where if you want to cherry pick data, you can certainly make a case for more frequent meals having a greater effect. However, a good scientist is always willing to change his opinion if research emerges to show you otherwise. And this is a case where my lab carried out a recent meta-analysis. So we looked at all the research done since the 1960s on the topic. And with respect to fat loss, there really is no credence to the recommendation that more frequent meals will result in better fat loss, that it's going to stoke your metabolic rate. And really, we looked at it from every angle. And now, at the very low end, it was hard to say with 1 meal a day, there just wasn't enough evidence to, in my opinion, concretely show that that would still be okay. But certainly from 2 to 6 meals, there was nothing we can find that would show any benefit from the literature. Now, that said, that does not take into account body composition. That is specifically on weight loss, really, and fat loss. With respect to body comp, although I can't say the evidence is conclusive here, I would say with a fairly decent amount of confidence based on the current evidence that we need at least 3 meals a day to optimize anabolic response, meaning muscle growth. So basically the time course for anabolism from a protein-rich meal is about 5 to 6 hours. And when I say eating every 5 to 6 hours, that would be a protein rich meal. So 3 meals a day, basically your breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the old standbys, 3 meals a day, would help to optimize anabolism. That to me would be a minimum for getting a maximal anabolic response and to promote muscle growth and muscle development.
Man, so we just should have stuck with 3 meals a day. We didn't have to go back and forth.
Well, so here, but let me also say, Kevin, that there also is something to be said. And this really is one of my, a pet thing that I like to promote here. It should come down to adherence, to what your preference is at this point. If there's no difference, it doesn't mean that 6 meals a day is useless. And it doesn't mean that 3 meals a day would be bad either. So if you like eating, some people like the regimentation of smaller frequent meals, great. There's no negative effects within the context. And I will say that with that is assuming that you are hitting what's called a leucine threshold with your protein. So having a minimum for a younger individual of about 20 grams of protein per meal, if you're going to start having multiple small meals with little amounts of protein, then it can have a problem, because if you don't hit what's called this leucine threshold, it's been shown that that leucine drives anabolism. Leucine is an amino acid, and it's considered to be a key regulator of protein synthesis. So if you don't get enough leucine in a meal for a given period of time, it's thought that you're not going to have the anabolic response. But given that, it's all adherence. So just like with low carb versus high carb, you can be successful on many different nutritional regimens. If low carb is going to work for you, you find it easier to stick with, great. If you like eating carbs, again, as long as you're going to be within an energy balance and hitting your protein requirements, your basic fat needs, there's really no issue with that as well.
Back in the day, one of those great websites that has articles sold a lot of leucine based on one of the articles that they posted about that. I don't know, just again, memories. All right. So in terms of like adherence, let's stick on that for a second, because again, you're working with tons of people, you know, just statistically, what are you finding that people have an easier time, you know, adhering to the 6 or the 3?
Well, so it depends upon what population you're talking about. If you're talking about a bodybuilder, they will basically do anything necessary to compete. So that when you work with a bodybuilder, the beauty of working with a bodybuilder, as long as they buy into what you're saying, you tell them, look, I want you eating 6 meals a day. They'll bring their little Tupperware canisters with them, and they'll just munch down food every 3 hours throughout the day. They'll pour in their fish oil into it, and it doesn't matter how it tastes. So that they're the anomaly. The other one that'll do that is the bride-to-be that I've worked with. I tell them to eat wheatgrass 4 times a day because they'll fit into their size 4. They'll do that as well until their wedding. But for the majority of people, look, it's generally difficult for most people to adhere to a structured eating schedule. But I don't want to give a catch-all there, because some people find it beneficial. Back in the day, I got into the habit of doing that, and my stomach would tell me every 3 hours, hey, it's time to eat now. Yeah. So once you develop that habit, again, it's I did read, and I'm not sure of how this was figured out, and I've not seen the research, but that if you do something every day for a month consistently, it becomes habit and you just do it. So to an extent, I think that there is some credence to that, but you also can fall out of that habit. I do think that a more flexible eating pattern, 3 or 4 meals a day, tends to be more doable for the majority of people.
Somewhat related, for people that are having issues trying to stick to the program that you're giving them, what are your strategies for people that are just having problems following the nutritional advice or even the training advice that you're prescribing? Because they're obviously paying you money to do it, but at the end of the day, it's up to them to get in those meals, stick to those, those guidelines. What do you do?
Yeah, you know, so that's the real conundrum, and I am not a psychiatrist, so you do try to talk to them. Especially with food, what's the real issue is that it's so abundant in society. So food is just around everywhere. You know, it's not only a matter of getting it from your grocer, but you go to work and people have food, you go out to eat and there's just food around, excuse me, certainly alcohol as well, which alcohol, some people don't count. They think, well, the liquids don't count. Well, you know, six beers, that's not part of my caloric intake. somehow separately, you know, you just pee that out and the calories don't count. Pee out the calories.
Whatever you got to do to justify it.
Right. But so it comes down to talking with them. And what I've found to be successful often is appealing to their motivation as to how bad you want it. So I can't give someone motivation. I can inspire someone by walking the walk, talking the talk, advising them on evidence-based practice and what's going to be best for them. But if they are not inherently motivated, if there's not a reason, that's why I said like a bodybuilder or a bride-to-be, they are motivated. Mm. So when there's not going to be an issue there, when someone is not adhering, usually it's a lack of motivation. And really the way I try to approach it is appealing to, hey, why do you want to do this? If it's not important to you, then you're paying me to really for nothing. Cause I can't be there and spoon feed you and slap your hand when you're going to the refrigerator or being out at a restaurant. So if you're not going to practice caloric energy balance, caloric control, you have to consider what's the reason you want this, how bad do you want it? And if you want it bad enough, then I can help you to get there. So sometimes that does work, sometimes it doesn't. And when it doesn't, really there's not much you can do to motivate someone because that does come from within. Mm-hmm. They don't have that internal drive to achieve something about the program that you're giving them, whether it's body composition, better strength, better health. There isn't much anyone can do.
One of the other questions that we got was just in general in terms of like supplement recommendations, just for people that are, again, trying to maximize their benefits or the results, and from all the work that they're doing in the gym and making sure that they're sticking to things outside of the gym. Are there any general supplement recommendations that you make that are, you know, backed by research that can show us that they're, you know, worth the cash?
Yeah. So here I'll give you some interesting things. Number one, one of my recent research made analyses was on meal timing, mm-hmm. or nutrient timing, which has to do with consuming protein immediately after a workout. And really, so I had been another big proponent of this as well. And then my buddy Alan Aragon started appealing to me with some of the recent research. And I started looking into this and realized that it wasn't nearly as clear cut as been proposed. We did a meta analysis, which really showed no effect or very little effect to protein timing, meaning that the take protein timing, for those who don't know, means that there is a theory that you should consume a protein rich meal within about 45 minutes to an hour post workout to maximize anabolism, the anabolic response. So there's the evidence really is not very compelling on it. And what Alan and I, from looking at the evidence, came up with, that it really comes down to the proximity of the meal to your training bout. So if you're eating within, let's say, a 4 or 5 hour period, which, as we discussed before, is the approximate anabolic threshold for a protein-rich meal, that's how long the anabolic response lasts, that's how long you can wait after your workout. So let's say you had a protein-rich meal 2 hours before your workout. The workout lasted an hour. You'd have like 2 hours, maybe even three, before you really needed to consume protein. That said, I still personally consume a protein-rich meal post-workout because we still don't know. And I do recommend a whey protein sometime post-workout. And again, you don't have to get overly anal about this and slug it down. I see people bringing a canister to the gym, and the minute they finish, they're chowing down protein. But within a reasonable, within an hour or so would be a decent period of time after or so to consume some protein. And whey is shown to have a high leucine content. And if it does maximize the response, which, again, when in doubt, I say, let's go for it. Do I think it's going to have a huge effect? No. Could it have a somewhat of an effect if your goal is to maximize muscle? Yes. We're actually, by the way, my lab is carrying out a study on this and in collaboration with a lab out of Texas and my good colleague, Colin Wilborn, where we're looking at giving someone protein pre-workout versus post-workout and seeing if there are any differences. Cool. So basically testing that hypothesis, and I might change my opinion based on that. But so again, a good whey protein shake sometime after your workout, within an hour or two post-workout, is a good thing to do. I would say creatine is the one supplement that is really shown to have good efficacy. So I do highly recommend for those who are looking to maximize the anabolic response, taking some creatine. It's one of the most studied supplements on muscle building. It consistently has shown benefit and really has not shown any negative. So it has a very high risk reward. Fish oil is something I do promote. There is some, I know, recent talk about how the evidence has been misconstrued, but it's pretty compelling that you do need some fish, that you need omega-3s in your diet, and specifically the DHA and EPA byproducts that are inherent within fish oil, that they have. Again, I think it's a very good risk-reward supplement, so a couple grams a day of that. And then some other supplements could or might not have benefit. There is some evidence that beta-alanine might be beneficial. I'm still on the fence about that with the current research, but for those who do glycolytic type training, which is kind of a bodybuilding style, 6 to 12 rep training, sprinting, hit type workout, it's been shown to hit, meaning high intensity interval training, not hit, single set training, that there might be some benefits there as well. So there is some good evidence. If you also want, my lab recently carried out in collaboration with with my colleague, Dr. Ribeiro in Brazil, a study on CLA, a conjugated linoleic acid. And we again found really no beneficial effects in humans on that. So that's a supplement that I do not recommend.
Oh, man, this is like going, you know, back to the past. CLA was, that was a supplement. That was a supplement that was just going to melt the fat off your body.
Let me just, if I don't mean to interrupt, Kevin. Yeah. That's, again, this is where we can look at individual studies, and mm-hmm. that's why really the importance of taking what's called the evidence-based approach. It's not exactly looking at, and by the way, where were the early studies carried out in CLA? They were in hamsters, in rats, and we know that that does not necessarily translate into human research. So we need to be careful in just looking at Science Direct will give a splashy headline or the media on a new study. We have to look at the context of it. We have to consider it within the body of literature. Mm-hmm. So we can only go by what we have at the time, but be skeptical. If your only literature is based upon hamster studies, I'm not saying to dismiss it, because there is certainly a lot of benefit to doing animal studies, but there is a hierarchy of evidence, and the generalizability is a very important aspect in terms of trying to get draw applicable conclusions from results.
I still remember back in college that my buddy was looking at it on a website, and this is when I started like getting into research for school and showing them, probably not a really great sign that they're citing a single research paper and not multiple papers, at least. Yep. You know, probably something you should watch out for. That's so supplement industry, man, I could talk about that forever. I still find it super fascinating what they're able to kind of sneak in these days. And also at the same time, just, you know, how much it's just incredibly, incredible advertising.
Well, a good scientist and a good practitioner is always skeptical. Mm-hmm. So that is the basis of being a scientist, that we look at research and we are skeptical of it. So we form conclusions when there becomes a compelling body of research, but there's many theories that have come into high degrees of scrutiny. Right now, the cholesterol hypothesis: does cholesterol really drive heart disease? Mm-hmm. That was a longstanding tenet, and now it's been certainly called into question. At best, you can say that there is equivocal evidence now for it, and that we need to reconsider a lot of what we once thought was just the be-all, end-all of evidence.
Being the internet, just being a pool of stuff that just pops up to you on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that. I remember seeing recently perhaps some discussion on the timing of creatine intake, you know, having to, you know, get it post-workout, like within an hour post-workout. Is there any credence to any of that stuff?
Yeah, my colleague Joey Antonio, who's head of the ISSN, carried out a study on that and did. That is what was found. Now, again, that was a single study. I think at this point, I would recommend that. That's what I would recommend. Am I convinced? So I recommend that just because there's no evidence otherwise. Sure. And there's evidence for it. Is that compelling evidence at this point? I think we still need more to show if it really matters that much. I don't think there's a downside to it. Based upon what I've seen, do I think that other research will come out showing that it's best to do it first thing in the morning before training or something? No. So without any other evidence, I think it's kind of a default position that that would be the best bet.
Just in all the research that you're doing, or just for you personally, what are you fascinated by these days? What do you want to, you know, take a deeper look into?
Yeah, one thing that really fascinates me, and I've been carrying out really a lot of research in this area, is the repetition range. Mm-hmm. So my lab has carried out now a bunch of studies on this topic. I've done a meta-analysis, and particularly looking at light load training. So it was often thought that you could not get like anything over 12 RM was useless for hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. We've now provided very compelling evidence where I can pretty much, with a very high degree of confidence, state that is not the case, that you can get good muscle growth training in a wide variety of rep ranges. My lab just published a study showing that 10 reps, it was 10 reps versus 30 reps per set in well-trained lifters got the same basic muscle growth. Now, what really fascinates me is number one, the application of this in terms of programming, but also there is some pretty compelling evidence now coming out of Russia that the fiber type specific response is different between the training styles, meaning that when you train with high reps, that it's getting a much greater response in the type 1 fibers, the endurance-based fibers, and the type 2 response is heightened through more heavyweight training. And that, if proven true, now my lab just looked at the overall size of the muscle. We didn't do biopsy work. The lab in Russia that's carrying out this work now has shown this in 5 studies now. So when you start seeing 5 studies showing the same thing, that starts to give you some real confidence in the results. And if true, that would really lend credence to the theory and to the recommendation that you should use a variety of rep ranges in your training if your goal is muscle hypertrophy to maximize the response. Hypertrophy is predicated on maximizing type 1 and type 2 hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. So if you can maximize type 1 hypertrophy through higher rep training and type 2 by lower rep training, that would be a working theory in terms of how you should carry out your programming. And it's certainly something that I do in the programming I give my that I recommend to people I consult with.
Fascinating. So are you thinking of, like, how high are you thinking about going for these rep ranges?
Yeah. So I generally like to have like a 1 to 5, your basic strength phase, 1 to 5 or 3 to 5, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Your hypertrophy is 6 to 12, 8 to 12, somewhere in there. And your high is 15 plus. I like to have a default around 20 usually, but it could be, let's say, 15 to 25. We went as high as 30. I will tell you, Kevin, one of the real interesting things that was very eye-opening to me, people think when you do very high rep training, it's for wusses. You train heavy, train like a man. You hear this stuff, and
it's the exact opposite.
The subjects in my study love training. They looked forward to their 3 to 5 rep days because you can grunt that out. Literally, the people that are in the 30 rep group, half my subjects puked during the first week, and really it was grueling because there's a huge amount of acidosis. You have to really have a lot of fortitude. It's a 90 second, 80, 90 seconds of constant training where you're pushing your body. And the lighter you go, the more important it is to go towards failure as well. So if you just, it's not like doing your pink dumbbell Tracy Anderson workout. This is where you're really pushing yourself at a 30 RM or a 20 RM. So again, I don't think you necessarily need to go as high as 30, but a 20 RM, I think, is a rough guideline for that.
Very cool. I'd be interested to see, how that research continues to go. We also got a question from the audience about the Max Muscle Plan. It came out in 2012. Are there any changes that you would have made, if it came out today? Any additions?
Yeah, that is really a great question. And so the big one that I would say is that I would change the nutrient timing guidelines, and not even change the guidelines, but change the way that I discussed it, because I talked about the importance of nutrient timing there, and I would really downplay that. But actually, the overall recommendation I gave, I just said before, to consume some protein after the workout still stands. I also talked about the importance of carbohydrates. I would change that because I don't feel that consuming carbohydrates really has much, if any, benefit post-workout, unless you're doing two-a-days, which I really don't see much of a reason to do. So if you're doing a morning session and then an evening session, yeah, then it, for the same muscle group, I can see that being a benefit. But other than that, really the nutrient timing, I would change the way that I talked about it, because I stressed the importance of it based upon the evidence that I'd seen at the time, and I've changed my mind on that. And the other thing that I'm playing around with at this point, I just had a study that came out on training frequency. So in my three-day-a-week routine, a lot of times I would just do a bro split where I would do my hypertrophy three-day-a-week routine. So I do a four-week block of, let's say, chest, back, and abs one day, legs another day, and then shoulders and arms another day. There might be a benefit, and I've actually been playing around with this, to doing a total body routine Monday, Wednesday, Friday for that three-week period. Then the next block going to a two-day split over a four-day period, so upper, lower, Monday, Tuesday, rest Wednesday, upper, lower, and then going to a bro split for a six-day routine where you're doing that like push-pull Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, take Thursday off, then Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So really that one block of four. But these are, again, minor tweaks. Do I think they're going to have an overall huge effect? No. I'm always looking to tweak what I do to maximize the response. But for the majority of people, if that's going to grind out an extra little bit of muscle, most people would probably find it not, you wouldn't even notice it for, but so here's another important thing to consider. The practical meaningfulness is really specific to the individual. Mm-hmm. I can tell someone what's going to optimize their results, but they then have to consider, is that going to be practically meaningful? Just like I mentioned earlier in the interview, if you're a 70-year-old woman, does it matter to you that you can gain an extra few pounds of muscle by training more days a week? Probably not, for probably the most of them, that as long as they're getting their basic fitness and they can carry out their activities of daily living, they're not looking to be on the beach in a bikini at that age. So again, that's where you have to take into account the needs and abilities of the individual, and what their goals are. So those would be the two primary things that I'd consider tweaking. But overall, the program is very consistent with what I'd recommend.
Well, you can still check it out. It's the Max Muscle Plan. It's literally only $15 on Amazon now. It's, you know, a no-brainer. And even if you hate paper, it's even a Kindle version now. Yep. For $10. Like, no-brainer. So before we wrap it up, Brad, anything else that people should keep an eye out for, events that you have coming up, or even articles that you know, people should check out?
Yeah, well, I do a lot of speaking, so I'm going to be at the internationally. I'm going to be speaking at the ISSN conference in in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. In June, I'm speaking at the NSCA National Conference in Orlando in July, the UK Strength and Conditioning Association in August in England, and then I'm going to be in Norway in September with Brett Contreras and Alan Aragon and Eric Helms and a bunch of other really great speakers. And finally, and then in Barcelona in September and Brazil in October. So you can follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, as well as check my website, and I will be posting that. But I love spreading the science. I'm an educator at heart, and I love interacting. So please, if you're around, come up and say hello.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a hell of a itinerary you got there. That's a lot of travel. But at Brad Schoenfeld on Twitter, again, these days, Twitter seems to be the best place to just get up to date on what everyone else is doing. And as I mentioned before, lookgreatnaked.com. And as Brad mentioned, on Facebook, you can get a hold to him on there. But, you know, I'm thinking like this is definitely going to be like one of those intro episodes, and I'm hoping the audience, you guys, this is going to be up to you to come back with a bunch of questions and, you know, to see what you want to, you know, hear from Brad about. And Brad, I'd love to have you back on the show soon. Just super fascinating stuff, and I just love what you're doing.
Thanks, Kev. It was my pleasure, and really great questions and informative interview. Hope everyone enjoyed it.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget, you can check out the FitCast on iTunes. If you enjoy the show, would love if you submitted a review on there, and at FitCast on Twitter, at Kevin Larrabee for the show and for myself. And finally, if you enjoy the show and you want to help support it going forward, you can go to patreon.com/thefitcast, and you get a bunch of benefits for supporting the show through there. So thanks as always for listening. And Brad, thanks again.
My pleasure. Fun. I'm gonna